Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Today, we finally set the record straight as we present to you the official Friends from Work podcast MCU Multiverse Saga film only rankings. That was very much Michael Scott. Some people still know how business is done.
So many modifiers, but all necessary.
A couple of weeks ago, we did our Friends from Work official MCU Infinity Saga rankings, ranking all of the projects from the Infinity Saga. Today, we're going to be splitting the Multiverse Saga into films and TV. So today is the film side of things. I think we only have about 13. We'll explain our reasoning in a minute, but I'm excited about this. We have gone back and forth on this for a long time. Today, We're officially going to kind of put it in stone. Here we go. Couple of disclaimers really quickly. We're going to use the same rules as last time. We have five tiers here, which during the middle of the episode last time, we actually changed the writing behind each tier. So we have tier four, which is what we call okay. These are okay films. Tier three, pretty good. Tier two, these are really good / great films. Tier one, the best of the best, elite. And then we have this special S tier that has really saved Robbie and I in that these are usually really, really good films, but because of some other cultural context, we have a weird time ranking these next to some, you know, films that were released 20 years ago in some cases. Obviously the Multiverse Saga, we're not going back that far. But that's a special tier. That's reserved for just a few projects. And then last time we used our official Friends from Work rewatch order as the order of the rankings. Today, since that order is still developing during the Multiverse Saga, we're going to be using the actual release order. And so last week we threw Black Widow into the Infinity Saga rankings, even though it technically released way after. Today, we're doing the opposite in that we're going to start today's episode with Spider-Man Far From Home because that is clearly an epilogue to Endgame. It released after Endgame. We see Endgame as the, get this, end of the saga. And so we're going to start today, Robbie, with a film that actually released during, quote, the Infinity Saga, although Kevin Feige has reckoned that, with Spider-Man Far From Home.
Man, I also want to note before we jump in here, the reason we're doing the films at this moment, it's technically Thunderbolts marks the end of Phase 5 from the MCU perspective. So I do think it's weird because we're about a month away as we're recording this from getting another film. But I think that this is the natural point for us to kind of do a reflection. Mm-hmm. And then we'll probably do something else, you know, in a couple of years after we get to the end of the entire Multiverse Saga. But Far From Home. I often hear people debate whether the Captain America or Spider-Man trilogies are better. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason that's the debate is those are certainly the most consistent of the trilogies that we've gotten. And I think that's the answer, yes. Yeah, I think that that's probably right. but I think Far From Home is the one that, like, I think if you look at those trilogies, the first Avenger would be for a lot of people what kind of brings the Captain America average down. And slightly. I think Far From Home, if you listen to certain people, would be that film for the Spider-Man trilogy. And I remember the last time that I watched this, I thought, man, this movie, if this is the worst movie in the Spider-Man trilogy, the Tom Holland one, and it is, holy cow. Like, that is a high floor. Because I think that this movie's great.
I think it's maybe even elite. And I know this is where we maybe differ. It has 92% Rotten Tomatoes, 91% audience or something. It's one of the highest Rotten Tomatoes scores ever given on within the MCU. And I remember where I was when I watched this film, which is already a calling sign of a really, really great film, just because I was very nervous about what's going to happen this immediately following Endgame. We wanted Endgame to give some film some space.
Right.
And I remember this film was a huge part of kicking off this podcast in the first place. I was walking around at in a parking lot in Iowa outside a hotel, having just watched it, calling you saying, son of a, you know what? They've done it again. Somehow it still is good. I don't get it. It shouldn't be good. They should be out of, you know, aces up their sleeve, but somehow it still really works. I still think I don't fully understand why it's not elite. I think because I don't have the long-standing Spider-Man background, which I know, shout out to our friend Dan Gavazdin, who runs a Spider-Man podcast. For someone like him, I think he doesn't see Spider-Man in this movie the way he knows Spider-Man. It's not poor Spider-Man. There's no Uncle Ben talk. It's not him wrestling with the same kind of things that he's used to Spider-Man wrestling. For me as an MCU fan, who doesn't have a lot of that baggage, I'm kind of viewing Spider-Man, not baggage, but you know what I mean, preconceived notions. I'm viewing Spider-Man through the lens of the MCU. So I like that Tony Stark's mentoring him in the first movie. I don't understand why this isn't an elite follow-up. So I know you and I are going to differ there. I don't think there's any acting concerns. I don't think there's really any visual concerns. I think Jake Gyllenhaal does a great job. I think it's a pretty fun villain. It's a pretty great third act. I think the romance on the bridge at the end, the music's pretty great. Michael Giacchino steps up his score a little bit. Some of the love themes. I think it's funny.
Yeah.
I saw when I was recording the clip that you just saw on this podcast, I remember the scene in the museum with Happy, and it's pretty funny, and they're confessing things. And I just don't have any qualms with this film. So it's going to be hard for us to decide between two or one. But
yeah, I think for me, it's not quite as tight as Homecoming. And that to me is a clear tier one. And I think part of that is, like, in isolation, I think Far From Home, it like I said, it is great. Like, I don't think that there's any real doubt about that. Everyone's doing a great job. The fact that they brought Mysterio to screen as effectively as they did.
And the visuals with him? Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. I love how kind of meta the Jake Gyllenhaal villain is at a time.
Well, someone get this stupid cape off me.
Yeah, it's like people were really talking about the superhero fatigue even then, especially following Endgame, when it's kind of like, okay, you know, like, what else are we about to do, like, 2 months later? I think Endgame, because it was re-released, was probably in theaters at the same time as Far From Home at one point. But I do think, like...
By the way, how about that twist? Like, my mom still... The first time, you know, he takes the glasses off and the whole thing goes.
He's been so nice. Oh, that
my mom was
so
like,
good. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
He's bad?
I think that one thing about this movie that to me puts it under Homecoming is thematically, it's not super clean in terms of like the arc that Peter's experiencing. Like it feels like one of these situations where, and this makes sense, like if John Watts had told, almost like Guardians, like if John Watts is a good friend of mine.
Is he really?
If John Watts had told this
shout out
story across just three films, I think it probably would have had like a cleaner arc. But I think that because Infinity War and Endgame were between Homecoming and Far From Home, it kind of created a little bit of like wonkiness, like at a high level. And again, it's not that I necessarily fault the film for that, because it had to do what it had to do. But like, Homecoming was all about Peter kind of learning to respect the importance of being the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. And then I think Far From Home is kind of dealing with, oh, he's refusing to go bigger and to do bigger things. And I think that ultimately that all, like in No Way Home, they did a great job of making that one large origin story. And it kind of traces, you know, in the macro, like what the Raimi Spider-Man film did in the first like half hour. Famously ending with Ant-Man. We'll talk about that in No Way Home. But I do think that it took No Way Home to tease out what that was. And I just think it was a little like, it was doing a lot because it was cleaning up from Endgame. like, I wish that this had come out in our, the way that we've started watching it and our yet to be finalized multiverse order, which is after Falcon the Winter Soldier. And so then you kind of have WandaVision and Falcon the Winter Soldier to do a lot of the work of the post-Endgame world. Mm-hmm. Because the stuff that I, you know, like, I like the Tony Stark reflection in Far From Home.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like a lot of the stuff with Nick Fury about, like, well, now what? You know, we don't have any superheroes. Like, that is also a little bit undercut by the reveal and the credits to me still. That it's like if it were actually Nick Fury saying, okay, all of my guys are gone now, and I'm going to pick Spider-Man to be the new guy. I think that would be, like, I would have liked that, because there's something to...
That's a, like, fair point.
You know, Nick Fury came and recruited Iron Man at the very beginning of the MCU, and now he's doing that with Spider-Man in this movie that's supposed to kind of call back. But, and you know, we've talked about that from the beginning. I think that they ultimately did some great stuff with it. But again, like, there are things like that that I'm not sure that that was what Watts would have preferred if he hadn't been, like, juggling other concerns.
Okay, so very, 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 very top of tier two. Just remember that, if not tier one. So I'm gonna compromise by putting in tier two, but just be careful how many things we put above it then.
I think that's fair.
Up next, Shang-Chi in The Legend of the Ten Rings. I flew to Austin to see you for this screener. I remember mm-hmm. that. And we sat in a hotel post Shang-Chi in The Legend of Ten Rings and talked about Infinity War and Endgame for 3 hours in the lobby.
Yeah.
I think for you and I, the Infinity Saga is so clean in our rankings. There's very little disagreement. Mm-hmm. We've talked about it ad nauseum. We've also worked through some stuff, like the Black Panther thing last time was so clutch, moving Black Panther to S tier.
Yeah.
The Multiverse Saga is a little bit more difficult. Not only have we not rewatched it as many times, we haven't had as much time with it, but also there is a chunk in the middle of tier two that we just go back and forth on all the time.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be Far From Home, Shang-Chi, Multiverse of Madness, Love and Thunder, that we are constantly reorganizing Black Widow in that, although we ranked it a couple weeks ago. But this kind of starts this new trend with us where it's like, man, I'm not sure the exact order of this. I think Shang-Chi for me is a tier two film because I think it's really well done. But I remember leaving feeling a little bit wanting. Like, there are just some things about it that I didn't leave going like, oh my gosh, slam dunk elite. I think it's funny. The bus fight scene's really cool. I think he and Katie's dynamic works pretty well. The whole family dynamic works pretty well. The history with his father, I think Wen Wu turns in a good performance, and his father makes for a good villain. But towards the end of the film, it gets a little bit weird, I think, when we're in a different dimension and there's dragons and soul suckers. And then while we're fighting this epic battle, like, for the universe, we have people like Katie with clutch shots and Trevor making jokes, who we think is really funny. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it kind of kicked off a discussion of when is too much of a good thing too much.
Yeah.
So there are just things in this that I don't find it, like, remarkably rewatchable. And I think there are some visual things that I think a lot of the COVID era movies had.
Yeah.
There was definitely a overbearing process for the visual effects departments, famously from, mm-hmm. you know, 2020 to 23, you know? And I feel that a little bit in this movie. So I really, really, really like it. I think it's a great introduction of a new character. Sorry, this is long-winded. But I don't think it's a tier one film. I think it's tier two, and I think it's behind Far From Home for me.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's probably right. This is another one that, like, this got really great reviews.
Correct,
some of the best reviews of any multiverse saga film.
And there are some Shang-Chi truthers.
Yeah. I mean, here's my
thing.
This
is one
movie
that when we put it, like, fourth of whatever the phase was, we got criticism on Instagram.
This is one where I would not fault somebody for making it a tier one film. Like, I think that there's an argument to be made.
I think that's fair.
Especially when you look at the films that have, I mean, you know, I'm looking at the lineup in front of me right now, the rest of the films we have to rank. And it's basically this, in terms of films, it's this and Eternals that have just introduced an entire new franchise. And that's hard to do, right? Like you're ranking like a first film against a lot of follow-ups. I guess Deadpool and Wolverine would also maybe count in that way, although that's kind of complicated. But I do think it like gets you, like I'm invested in Shang-Chi as a character.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually really, really look forward to seeing him interact with other characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm a little bit biased against the fantastical type films in general. So that has to be said. Dragons and arrows and magic is not as much my scene as like a sci-fi thing. Just FYI.
Well, and you know, I think one thing I struggle with here, and this happens with certain Marvel films, you know, because the third act is often either when the movie like soars, like in the Avengers, or where it kind of like loses its way, depending on kind of how they ramp things up. And I think that there are really powerful moments in the third act. So I don't want to dismiss that. But I think you and I have talked before about how I think this could have been two movies. Like, I really like Shang-Chi as...
Yeah.
Like when they're in Macau, like when he's in San Francisco, like, I really like seeing him in the real world, like in a grounded setting.
Yep.
And like, I love the soundtrack to this
movie.
Wrestling
with
his
family's past.
Yeah. Like, I think, and I love Wenwu. Like, I think that that's a great part of this movie. And he's great across the entire thing. It's just like, even that, I would have loved to have another movie with him and then have his death there and like have them travel to this dimension there where you like preview it and you learn about how his mom's from there, but you don't actually see it until the second movie. It's like, you know, I feel like that's not that's a fairly common arc. And I think that would have been nice because it's a little strange to me timing wise that we got this movie in September, 2021 and it's now June, 2025 as we're recording this. And we are, there is not a new Shang-Chi movie on the horizon that I'm aware of.
They're going to make one, but yeah, it's still years away for sure.
Right. Which is just kind of like,
he is in Doomsday. But yeah.
Right. Which is, but it, you know, if you look back at the normal rhythm, it was kind of every 2 years for the longest time.
Right.
And so, you know, I just think that there are some things there that it might've been a little bit better if they had like let that breathe and let us spend more time with him in that context.
Right.
But man, like the choreography in this movie is so great. Like, especially in those scenes, like we're talking about.
Yep.
There are some really emotional moments, really funny moments, like the mega soul sucker line at the end. Like Awkwafina is kind of hit or miss for me in most roles. And she is like, she consistently hits in this one. I find her really funny. So I think top of tier two is right, but I think it's probably not quite to go by your normal, like your litmus test. I would feel a lot more comfortable, I think, showing an average person Far From Home.
Yeah, sure.
Than I would Shang, or at least a little bit more comfortable. A lot is maybe a reach, but I think that there's less to explain for like newcomers.
And I just don't find myself going back to this film very often. To be honest, like 4 years in, I've probably seen it, I don't know, doesn't matter, 4 or 5 times.
And part of some
films I come back to.
Part of that, though, might be, you know, it's like what we talk about with Thor. Like if
that's
once
true.
We get some additional follow-up and additional investment.
Yeah, I haven't had a reason to yet.
Yeah.
Other than just if you want to watch it. Before we get any further, I want to take one quick second to say, check out our new Friends From Work merchandise. Robbie is wearing it. We made some dope Friends From Work Fantastic Four inspired. How about that right there?
Man.
Doomsday inspired t-shirts. They're really high quality. They feel great. We have a few left. I'll mail them to you right now. Go to our website, theffwpodcast.com/shop. You can find that and other Friends From Work merchandise. It's a great way to support the podcast and look cool and feel good while you're doing it. Okay, The Eternals, same thing. A lot of these films, because it's recent history, I'll never forget where I was. I actually went to this screener in Nashville with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And this is almost S tier in that it's one of the hardest films for me to rank. It's not S tier for the same reason at all. I'm kind of making a joke. But I actually think, I've said this before, I think this film is pretty good. I like a lot of what Chloe Zhao brought to this movie. I think she really cared. And I think it doesn't feel very formulaic. And I love that. I really do. And I think visually, it's pretty striking. Just look at the clip that we're showing right now. The way Icarus flies looks like ahead of its time. Yeah. And the lasers and the fighting they do is cool.
Especially in this era, like you're saying, when I think visuals were consistently a concern.
And I actually think a lot of the dynamic amongst the group works pretty well. I also think it's pretty cool to go back in history. Yeah. As a sucker for history, I like seeing, I think it's like Babylon here and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I like a lot of what they're doing. I also like that they're very sincere characters. Like, they love humanity, and that's their sole purpose, is to protect that. And then having to wrestle with that, I think, is a pretty interesting dynamic for me. Here's my thing, though. I just don't understand how it works in the MCU. When Arishem shows up at the end, I don't understand how they can address that. Like, why has that never been brought up? How does no one see that? Someone of that galactic of a level, what to try to like explain away? Well, they've been there, but they didn't want to jump in because of during the Thanos era because of something is like, okay. I mean, that feels like a little bit like you probably would have been there if you loved humanity. There are a lot of things like that where I'm like, man, if this film wasn't in the MCU, it was just Marvel Studios makes a new film, Eternals, or get this. In the multiverse saga, if they had just set this in another universe, I think it's a win.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. I think it's probably tier three or tier two if it's in a different universe.
Yeah.
But the fact that you're asking me to believe that some of them were friends with Thor and stuff is a little bit like, it's just strange. It feels like you're forcing that in. And then the last thing is, it's a pretty long movie. And some of the plot points don't fully mesh. You're a little bit like, what are the deviants doing? Like, why are they having to fight these monsters? And how does that work with them wrestling with their purpose with Arishem and being kind of robots? There are a few things like that where you're like, I'm not sure that works great on paper. So it's weird. It's weird because I think it's the lowest rated MCU film in a lot of ways. Maybe Quantumania for some people, Secret Invasion for some people, as far as projects goes. But I actually think it's not in that category for some reasons, but for others it is. So I guess I'm here tier four. Okay. But it's a weird film to rank.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's probably right. If it's tier four, it's very top of tier four. I agree with you completely. I think what's strange is like you could in about 10 minutes edit the script for this film and it would not take place in the MCU. Like you remove
good point.
A reference to Thanos and a reference to Thor and Steve Rogers. And now we are in a totally different universe. And I think that that's telling. Because, I think if it weren't a Marvel movie even, like if it were just a sci-fi movie, I think it would have been really interesting. And I think a lot of people would have been intrigued and wanted to see more from Chloe Zhao in this vibe or maybe like a follow-up to this film. But I think this was in this era where Marvel was just like kind of machine gunning. And I think it was like, sort of the worst of both in that it was not really connected to the MCU within the film, but then it also kind of had these two post-credit scenes that were supposed to introduce different aspects of the MCU, neither of which have been followed up on. So, and then, you know, there's like, I'm with you, the further I get, why not make this like Fantastic Four? Like, because that's the same problem we've talked about. How do you do Marvel's first family now that we're 20 some odd films in?
I also think the misstep came during Brave New World because it's cool to follow up on it. But if Brave New World had just ignored the Celestial Hand, you could still retcon. You could go back and go, this movie wasn't a different universe. It's just a different Thor they're referencing.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that was like their perfect get out of jail free card. It increases the value of this movie, especially during this multiverse saga. And you can wrap it up in Doomsday or Secret Wars and never have to come back to it and be like, that was a different universe. And, I mean, you know, their universe lost or whatever.
That's something that I think would have been such an interesting way to approach the multiverse saga overall is something like that. Like, okay, here's a follow-up on Spider-Man. And, you know, maybe it's No Way Home where it sort of connects to the multiverse, but it's primarily dealing with a 616 figure. And then now we're going to do this kind of showcase of, look at this other universe. And that way you can kind of keep people invested in your main universe as much as you want and connect it to the multiverse. But like, yeah, there were movies like this where it's like, what if you had like one movie a year that was just clearly set in a different universe? And Marvel's just having fun with it, kind of like an extended what if, except like with some more weight. But yeah, I think
and then you feel it even more when it shows up in Secret Wars, because now you've put the time in with that universe.
Well, and like Doomsday, or like what we're hearing they're wanting to do with these different teams from different universes. Like if we meet one of those, you know, every year, and then now we kind of have this natural investment. But as it is, it's sort of like, you know, we've talked about the kind of rush here at the end. So I don't know. Like, I don't know. I wonder like if that
casualty.
Was ever
It feels like a casualty. It feels like they legitimately made a mistake, which we never say about Marvel Studios, but they didn't fully grasp what the multiverse saga was or should have been. I think what is the through line here? Just the fact that they give a couple call outs. I don't understand. If you had foresight, I think that's the obvious way to do it, especially with Fantastic Four on the horizon, where they're coming out and saying it is a different universe. And then with Multiverse of Madness coming up in a second, they had the Illuminati from a different universe. So you were ready for that to happen. Then why not just also give us an investment in another one with Eternals?
It seems to me that this is such a clear example of Feige and Marvel trying to do the opposite of what they were always accused of doing, which is like steamrolling directors and making these films that feel more like Marvel films than they do like this director's film. And I think, you know, Chloe Zhao was coming off of an Oscar win, and this movie had a lot of kind of, oh, this is going to be a prestige thing. Which is why I brought it up when we talked about Thunderbolts, because I feel like that kind of had similar vibes. But I think the problem with Eternals is like, there's something to be said for Marvel exerting some level of control because of what they're trying to do. Like, it's different than A24, where like with A24, it's just a studio name. There's no, you're not telling one story. You're not trying to connect things in any way. They don't even have to be like thematically or tonally consistent. But when you're trying to tell an overarching story, if that is what you're trying to do, then you can't, like, no matter how much flack you get for it, you do have to keep a hand on the wheel. And this feels like the only person that had a hand on the wheel was Chloe Zhao. And the result is, I think, a movie that in isolation, I think is pretty good for a lot of the reasons you said, but I think as a Marvel film, is just okay.
And that brings us to Spider-Man No Way Home. I'll let you start too. I started the last couple.
Man. Well,
we love this movie.
This is one that I would say this is another example of, well, this is an example of a perfect multiverse saga film. Not even just like the mechanics of the film itself, but what it's trying to do. Like, if Far From Home felt like Watts was burdened with having to connect some dots and do things that maybe like weighed down what otherwise would have been a breezier Spider-Man film, this is him understanding the assignment in such like spectacular fashion, because you get something that is fully explicitly tied into the multiverse, introduces some of these concepts for the first time into the MCU, but is so character driven that it is one of the best Spider-Man movies in just in terms of Tom Holland's arc, like if you set aside the all the fun Toby Andrew stuff, but it also is such a great ode to like the Spider-Man live action franchise as a whole. And I think everybody felt like that they got what they wanted out of that for the most part, which is why this is one of those movies that became a cultural moment in a way that even Deadpool and Wolverine didn't, you know, more recently. So I think that like, this is where however you wanted to handle it, this is like, if Marvel had just done this, like, we're not going to show off all these different universes, or it's not all going to be that. We're going to have these check-ins where it's like, here's Spider-Man that does the multiverse, and here's Thor doing the multiverse, and here's Captain America, and like just showing all the ways that these things are breaking in. Like, that would have been a really different, like, more focused take. But regardless, this is the gold standard, I think, for the post-Endgame MCU.
I severely underestimated how much joy seeing the other two Spider-Man and those connections would give me. Prior to this movie, I was not well-versed in the Tobey Maguire or Andrew Garfield stuff. And then you and I on this podcast went back through those films. And I think that really helped because it combined the love of Spider-Man and those other Spider-Men with my love for just getting to see characters interact. So them just circled up, the three of them talking, both in the calm way before the storm and when it's actually going down, just gave me so much happiness, even probably beyond your happiness the first time viewing it, because I know you were unsettled originally. Yeah. Something happened in my heart. I don't know why. It's just so amazing. The Peter 3 is funny to me. The Avengers, what is that? How is this helping? Or when he goes, are you going to go dressed as a youth pastor? Yeah. But he really is kind of like a youth pastor because he's so positive. And he's like, that's great. What is that?
That is a sweet view, man.
Whenever someone disagrees with him, he's like, you know what? Yeah, that's great. I love this movie. I think this is a perfect S tier of the multiverse saga because... I agree. Specifically, when you compare it to Spider-Man Homecoming, it gets really tricky because this movie shoots its shot in a lot of ways in this, everything you talk about the multiverse saga, but it's not as tight. Some of the jokes don't work. Yeah. There's a couple of jokes early on, like there's no way that's his girlfriend. Then I'm like, man, that just could have been axed from the script. It's not funny. I don't know who it's funny to. And it makes the movie feel a little too kid-ish early on.
Yeah.
And Spider-Man Homecoming has basically none of that. But I also don't ever have the moment in Spider-Man Homecoming that I have here when the three of them are talking. And on the humor front, too. You got to watch where you fall. And man, those damn eels. Yeah. Like that kind of stuff is so funny to me.
And so, as much as like I was so happy and think it was like perfectly executed, but the Amazing Spider-Man 33, like lifting the rubble moment at the end of Homecoming is so well done. And I was so glad to see that adapted. But that is kind of the most emotional moment of that movie. And it does not even touch the most emotional moments of No Way Home, whether you're talking about
the Aunt May death. Yeah, the Aunt May death we haven't even brought up yet, which is one like of the best deaths ever in Marvel Cinematic history. Oh, man,
like gets me every time.
It wrecks me when Happy goes, Peter, run! And he's like, you know, losing it, his hearing. It's like hard to hear.
I mean, the follow-up to that, the scene with Andrew and Toby, the scene at the end whenever everybody forgets, the scene whenever he's talking to MJ and she doesn't remember him.
This poster even of him having to sit there listening to that about how everything has gone wrong in his life.
I think what I love about it from a Spider-Man perspective.
And then the final, like that this wraps up the Spider-Man trilogy in like his origin story now is wrapped by the end of this film.
And that's why I think like Far From Home is kind of hard for me sometimes, because like I said, if it were just those, I think No Way Home did a really great job of kind of cleaning up that arc and in some ways making Far From Home, I mean, it increased the impact of, or enhanced the impact of Far From Home, because of how much Mysterio letting out the identity sets off this like chain reaction. And that was the last thing I was going to say. I think my real nervousness around this film before it released was that, like, you and I were so intrigued by, oh, his secret identity is out. This has never happened in a Spider-Man movie in this way. What's that going to look like? And then it started looking like they were just going to dodge that entirely and just lean into multiverse stuff. And I was worried it was just going to be a fan service-y thing and that they weren't going to do any real development. And I love how much...
The whole movie's basically based on his identity being revealed.
And, I mean, and they find a way to... I mean, they really elegantly tie that into the multiverse where it doesn't feel shoehorned in. And that's... Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. That's all of that. And just the fact that this was a moment that I think... has only been topped by Endgame in terms of kind of the cultural conversation.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I think, yeah, this is a clear S tier for me.
It's also just, even if we didn't have the S tier, by the way, it's incredible. It's elite. We, before the S tier, had this movie somewhere in our top five. It was always Endgame and Infinity War, and then some version of Guardians, No Way Home, Civil War, and Ragnarok. Those four for the six overall always switched. But we've never really wavered on, man, the end of this movie, the last act, is unbelievable. Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is a film that you and I have disagreed on for a while. I think you and Candace went into viewing this movie and you can appreciate the Sam Raimi-ness of it. The fact that this director, like you said with Chloe Zhao, has a clear stamp on the film. I think it's one of the most... I think you would also say that for Love and Thunder. Like, this is an era where directors did have their own leeway. And you do feel the stamp more than just it's a Marvel film, for better or for worse. Sometimes for me in this film, it's a little bit for worse. I still think I feel something emotionally by the end with Christine. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the journey that Doctor Strange himself as a character goes on. A lot of the fundamental differences come from, do you like what Sam Raimi is doing with this? One, how multiverse-y did you expect this to be? And is it multiverse-y enough for you? And how do you feel like it treated Wanda Maximoff? And I think that I'm not really bothered so much by the first two. Even years later, I think I am still a little bit bothered by this being the end, as of now, of Wanda Maximoff's character, just because fundamentally, I'm not sure that Sam Raimi did understand the assignment coming from WandaVision, where I think you clearly are left at the end of the movie. I know there are things to reasons to believe that she's turned a little darker with the Darkhold, and like she still left the village and fled the scene. And I get it. There are reasons. But I think there still is a gap there in going from her kind of like putting her kids to bed and saying goodbye to Vision and her kids to she's now driven crazy by the lack of her kids in the Darkhold that she's willing to murder sorcerers, etc., just to change that. And I understand the Darkhold corrupts. Again, I understand. I don't need to get into that whole discussion. I just think for me, that keeps it towards the middle or bottom of tier two, just because I don't think that that fully tracks with what the MCU was doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I do wonder if when we inevitably get more of Elizabeth Olsen, and I have to believe that we will. I think that might be that might be less of a concern. You know, like when this doesn't feel like the end of her journey, because I do think that it makes a lot of sense, not just plot wise, but I think even looking at her character arc and where they could go with it. You know, it's like even by an Endgame before she unlocks her full Scarlet Witch powers, she's already one of the strongest, if not the strongest characters that we've been introduced to. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure where else you go with a character like that. Like, you know, with Thor, we had to have him broken down and built back up. We talked about this being sort of an issue with Captain Marvel that they've wrestled with. It's just once you have an overpowered character, you have to do something. You can't just keep the trajectory up. And so I think because of Wanda Maximoff's complicated history in the comics, because of how much nuance they were able to add within the MCU, I do think it made sense to just have her go like all out powerful and kind of lose it just to see like this is what it looks like when a character this powerful like loses all restraint. And I think
I appreciate that to a degree.
But I think, you know, it wasn't a natural follow-up from WandaVision. And I do think it was hard for people. You know, I've heard that Michael Waldron, who wrote this movie, was actually in conversation with Jack Schaefer as she was doing WandaVision. And I think he was really trying to make sure he honored that show. And I still think that I would put more of that on Waldron, I think, than Raimi, because I think that like they just jump into her as villain so quickly. You could like, I think even if it had been maybe a turn halfway through the movie, like something like when you find out Obadiah is the villain in Iron Man, where like for the longest time, you know, have her and Strange work together and then see how it's this thing that's like, she's a little sharper. There's something in the back of her mind that's like a little darker, and then see the reveal. But I think by just like, okay, here we are. Here's Wanda. She's bad. She's threatening Strange and America. She wants to kill a child. It's like, whoa, okay, this is very different from the version in WandaVision where she's like...
I do love her though. And I actually love that conversation. But yes,
like I think I see what you're saying. But I do think that like in the long run, if we kind of have Wanda come back and have a hero redemptive moment, I think that this will be better in retrospect as like an interesting stop on that journey.
Are you comfortable with the bottom of tier two, or is this a tier three film?
I think bottom of tier two is right.
There are some things it does well. Thor: Love and Thunder is a movie that a lot of people don't love, and you and I love, which is, you know, puts us in some unique grounds here. Yeah. Here's the thing. I think this is how we led off the actual initial reactions of the two. Like, is it too goofy at times? Yes. Does Taika and Chris Hemsworth, like, do they get a little bit carried away at times? Yes. Is gore a little bit underdeveloped? Should he have more time on the screen? Yes. Is it a little strange that he plays it so kind of zany? I think so, yes. Are there some visual aspects that don't work as well? Yes. But this is where the butt happens. Like, I don't feel things normally like I do at the end of this film. Like, in the MCU, very few films can make me cry. This one can make me choked up. I do think when the jokes hit, they are downright hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
I think the actual opposite of everything I just said, like those things exist, but also the Shadow Realm fight exists. So there are some goofy looking things. And there are also some things like the clip I'm playing that's unbelievable looking. There are some things that are too jokey, but then from the time that Jane kind of comes clean that she's dying to Thor, there are no more jokes through the end of the film.
Yeah.
So Taika understood embracing the seriousness of the moment after a certain point. But yes, does he let it go too far? Is there the boombox joke? Yes, like that stuff exists. But also, we get Thor at Jane's bedside in the hospital, just overcompensating and not knowing, finding himself and feeling like he's struggling through all this and like just stuff, some heavy emotional work that we just don't get from Marvel films very often that I love, like I adore. And then on top of all that, he's exploring some pretty deep thematic elements with what it is to be a god. What does that even mean? If you are a god in Norse mythology where people worship you, but now also you're just dating a human. And what does that even look like? And what does it look like then when your gods don't meet what you thought they should be for Gore or for Thor? So it's like, it's both. And it is too silly. Yeah. It is like, I wish the god meetup, was a little less like, I wish there weren't like creatures there. Yeah. I get it. Taika was being a little goofy.
Yeah.
But it's also funny and looks great and moves me emotionally heavily. And I know you're on, I talk for both of us on this. I speak for both of us because I know you're on the same page with that. Like we kind of left, we went to the world premiere of this film and thought it was awesome. And then we found out people didn't think it was as awesome, but we went back to it and we're like, I think it is still pretty awesome still.
Yeah. I think that this works really well alongside both seasons of Loki, weirdly enough. If you're looking at it from a perspective of those characters growing and kind of coming to understand their roles as gods within the Norse mythology. And I think it is doing something different with Thor. And I respect that because
absolutely
like that is something like, you know, and you could argue that the whole God thing, like it might've been cleaner if we just never delved into that because Thor was initially introduced just as an alien that was worshiped as a god. But I think that they did some, like that is a huge part of the character in the comics. And like I've said before, I think for as goofy as this movie is, if you read Thor throughout the decades, like it's a goofy character, not like it's a dumb character. I mean, like he is supposed to kind of do the fish out of water thing consistently and then have these really epic moments. And I think that this movie, it does a little bit too much of that at times, but it also gives us some of the most epic Thor moments. And all of it feels to me like, is it a great, like, it's not a perfect adaptation of the Jason Aaron stories that it's adapting. And I get that. But as someone that loves those Jason Aaron stories, I respect that Taika took that stuff and did his own thing. And one other thing that I want to mention here that I've been thinking about, Neil, one of our listeners that's active in our Discord, he said, and I'm sure you've seen this, that the way that he kind of no prizes some of the goofier moments of this movie is like all through the lens of Korg telling the story.
Right.
Which I kind of love because that is how the movie's framed. It starts and ends with Korg narration. And he's telling this. And so I like that does give you an out if you're watching this and you like the story and you like those moments that are emotional.
Right.
But you don't, you know, you think some of this stuff is a little over the top. Is it a cop out? Probably. Yeah, but I kind of like it.
Yeah. I also think it's the natural next step for Thor. We talk about Thor and his journey often on this podcast, fish out of water, kicked out of his kingdom, becomes a king again. Then he has Infinity War and he loses. And then that steers him into depression. And then in an endgame, he's way depressed and overeating and lazy and can't motivate himself. And then he kind of gets some redemption with that between his mother and then seeing Thanos and Tony and Steve again. And then where do you go from there? Where do you go from there? He's already been broken down. He's been a king. He's not been a king. He's been, you know, out of shape and depressed. So I think it actually handles it pretty well where he then decides, well, I'm going to get way back into shape and I'm going to become a god because I'm a god. And this is what we do now. And I've gone through all this. And so like the beginning of him is overcompensating. He's aloof because he's totally lost himself in what it means for him to even be Thor or a god. And so I think by the end, for him to settle in to the right decision is for me to lay down my axe in peace. That's an amazing direction for this to go.
Yeah.
After the four films or, you know, whatever, seven films he was in at that point, eight films maybe. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the sacrifice component, I think.
The sacrifice component was so clutch. You don't want him. You don't want to see him just murder more people.
Right.
Or try harder. On that front. So I think and that's the whole point too. The Guardians themselves are kind of rolling their eyes. And remember the people he saves, they're like, this is not at all what we signed up for. You know, you're ruining everything.
Right.
Because you're lost. Okay. Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Go ahead.
This is another one that I think you and I differ on.
Okay.
I recognize that this movie's too long. I think that's its biggest issue, and because of that, I think it gets a little aimless at points.
Sure.
My other issue is I still don't think that Coogler has nailed the final big battle. He's great in this one. One like big improvement over the first film is like the close up stuff. Like some of the hand to hand moments, yeah, I think are really cool. And some of the stuff with the I always forget because I'm used to like Marvel Comics lingo. But the Atlanteans from Talokan, like I think they like that stuff is well visualized, and I love like the scene on the like the bridge or the overpass or whatever.
Oh yeah,
when they come out of the water,
and the punches are all felt more than the first Black Panther.
Like, and I just think in general, with the exception of the ocean battle at the end, I think the visuals are really cool. I think the Ludwig Göransson music here is some of the coolest in the MCU, period. And
I'm still unsettled on the theme he landed on for Black Panther as Shuri.
Oh, see, I love that theme.
Okay.
But I understand that that's, you know, mileage may vary. But I think for me, this movie does, like, it's not perfect, but I think the primary thing it needed to do was deal with the loss of Chadwick. And it did that so deftly and so beautifully.
Correct.
And then it also introduced these new elements of the Marvel universe, I think really creatively and really well. Like, I can't really imagine anyone having introduced Namor more effectively than Coogler did here. Like, I'm so much more interested in his people and his story than I would be if it were just like kind of an Aquaman ripoff, which it could have been, even mm-hmm. though Namor predates Aquaman in the comics.
Shots fired.
But I do think, like, for me,
do you agree with our list thus far?
I do. I think if I had to guess, I think I would maybe put it behind Far From Home in tier two.
You think it's, I feel like you like Love and Thunder more, don't you?
I mean, and this is where it gets hard, but in fairness, like, I enjoy rewatching Wakanda Forever, and I
can
think
we that, compromise on this right here, one spot behind, that's my compromise.
I think that's fair.
Okay.
And also, you know, it's like the order within the tiers, I think,
right. I don't really have much to add. I agree with everything you said, basically. I feel the same way. As I sit here right now, I have watched 3 episodes of Ironheart before it came out. And that's one of my biggest concerns from Wakanda Forever, is that you didn't mention her. Storyline-wise, it's out of place. Visually, that's right. It feels out of place because you got these people fighting with spears, and then she's flying around in this futuristic, like, anime-looking Iron Man suit. So visually, it's also weird. And then tonally, I think it's a little bit weird. I think they tried to use Riri as some comic relief in a very heavy film. But
yeah,
it's a little bit strange for me to see her cracking jokes while they're in Talokan. And, like, you have people who are talking very gracefully and people who are talking very royally. And then she's kind of in there as the American going, like, girl, what? And I'm like, I don't vibe with it.
It almost reminds me of what you and I talked about, a more extreme version of what we talked about in Doctor Strange, the first one, where it's like, shouldn't Christine be a little bit more
shocked by all this? Yeah.
Like, I don't know that she should be able to make light of it quite yet.
Yeah, right.
And that's a fair point. Like, when she's waking up in Talokan, I think she should be kind of shell-shocked.
He came back a wizard, and he's going through portals. Like, you might want to ask him some questions. But as I sit here, I really enjoyed the first 3 episodes of Ironheart. And I do wonder if the plane is landed. And again, I reserve the right to change my thoughts on that. But I really liked the first 3 episodes. If that's landed, maybe I view this even differently then, a little bit. Yeah. In how she fits as a character. Here we go. Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. So Robbie and I flew to Los Angeles, and we watched this, not at the world premiere, but adjacent theater to the world premiere in Los Angeles the night of. And then we went back to our hotel room and we recorded a 2-hour episode just kind of geeking out about how much fun we had. Obviously, then the movie came out and people did not feel the same way. They did not have the same experience to the point where it started forcing us to ask questions like, what did we miss? How did we miss this? For the future, is there something we can learn about this? Over time, you then went home and watched with Candace, and Candace really didn't like it. She didn't think it was very funny, thought it was pretty goofy. Right. And then you're now sitting next to her going like, oh, like I see what you're saying, but we liked it. I, on subsequent watches, have become very aware of people's concerns with this film to the point where a lot of our listeners have it as the worst film in the MCU. And I will still just die on the hill that a couple of the things it does really well for me. And that's what makes it hard for me to throw it at the very bottom. I have been okay with moving it down since. Like, I think it was like top of tier two. Then it's kind of been middle of tier two. I'm thinking I'm okay with it being tier three. But here's the thing. Same thing I said with Love and Thunder. I think there are some goofy visuals. Mm-hmm. That I can kind of explain away via it's the quantum realm. Like it's supposed to look a little bit different. It's not hyper realistic.
Yeah.
I think there are some like younger feeling like Spy Kids type moments. I get that. There are times where like, I wouldn't be able to show this movie to everyone and be like, isn't this a slam dunk? I get that.
Yeah.
And I do wish that Kang was not defeated at the end. Although now with whatever happened, that's probably the right thing that they had that work out for them. But at the time, I think it was coming off Loki and we were like, oh my gosh, this is the big bad. They're talking about the big bad. And then he kind of gets defeated. Like if Scott had been stuck in the quantum realm and Kang had gotten out or something, like Kang had just been neutralized, but he couldn't get through the portal and they're both stuck there or something. I understand that's not where they wanted to go with it, probably for the future. But yeah. I get that. Like if he's Kang the Conqueror who can beat Thor, he probably should be able to get through that portal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So there are things like that. I'll just say for me, I laugh out loud. I think I just totally resonate with Jeff Loveness's writing. I laugh out loud at parts. A lot has happened here today, still makes me laugh.
Yeah.
And I think Paul Rudd's just naturally a funny dude. And I think it actually does some redeeming work for the original Ant-Man and Wasp that really are kind of throwaway characters in the first two. And now kind of have some important roles here.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're still a unit. And then the last thing is, I give them props like Star Wars for envisioning this quantum realm to have some goofy things. I think about like the Cantina sequence.
Yeah.
I think that I'm not going to fault a movie for doing really creative things. Even the ships they come up with are unique.
Yeah, and the ooze.
Yeah, like it's funny and I think it works. Like, why is that so outside the realm of possibility when we praise Star Wars for coming up with creatures that have main roles? And so like on that front, it's very original. So I understand the problems. I think for me, maybe we go tier three then as the compromise because our audience would have it down here at the very bottom of tier four. I'd probably have it in the middle of tier two. I guess tier three is the compromise. I see the problems. I hear you. But I still kind of like watching it. It's funny to me.
Yeah, I think that's fair from our perspective. Because, yeah, I mean, there are things about this. Like, I think the Kang stuff works well. I find a lot of the humor funny. And, you know, I think the reason why I was so high on this initially, as opposed to other Ant-Man films, is I kind of, especially at the time this came out, when it felt like, you know, the last two movies had been Thor and Wakanda Forever. And it was now, you know, a year since Multiverse of Madness. We had not gotten any multiverse updates in all like a slew of Disney Plus projects. And I think like what we were talking about earlier with the through line, it was just really nice to see them move the ball forward, follow up on Jonathan Majors, who is like an actor that we were really impressed with in Loki. And we were intrigued by the character. So like there's a lot about this that I think, like when we're weighing against Eternals, for instance, I think Eternals is a better, again, in isolation, a better film. But I think that as a Marvel movie, I really like that this, it could have been cleaner in a lot of ways. And I think the biggest issue with this movie is it was just a little underbaked. Like, I really wish that they had sat on this. And like, this is when the VFX stuff was in like crisis mode. And you just hear a lot of reports about how like, this is one that people, that it went out before some of the people working on it wish it had gone out. And that bums me out, because it's like that shouldn't happen. I don't think, like, historically Marvel's done a great job of not letting that happen. And I hate it when, like, you only get one shot, right? Like, now Jeff Loveness has to take the blame for what people see as this like atrocity, and people talk about the visuals and all this stuff. And I really think that with a little bit of tightening, I think a lot of that stuff would have gone away.
By the way, Jeff Loveness, our favorite interview probably ever on this show, at least for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like hearing his reasoning, and, you know, again, it's an Ant-Man movie, right? Like, I think,
people have lost a little bit the forest for the trees here. Yeah. When people are like wanting it to be crazy different, I'm a little bit like, it's Ant-Man. I mean,
like, it's going to be goofy.
You have ants.
And I think people people missed some of the groundedness. And, for sure. I think, again, there were a lot of weird things going on at this particular moment, including, correct, like, even setting aside the Jonathan Majors stuff, the fact that Marvel was in a position to say, this is the start, really, of like the next era. Like, now we're heading to the end.
Right.
And doing that in an Ant-Man movie also kind of creates some tension.
Underbaked is the perfect word, because I think the fundamentals of this film are there. But if you give it more time to make the VFX even like unbelievable looking, that helps get rid of some of the Spy Kids nature. You cut a couple lines, like, you gave me your word.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about that kind of thing doesn't work. Yeah. And you a little bit discuss for a little bit longer what the ending is going to be with Kang. And I think you have a pretty great movie, because I think Kang is great in this movie. And the dread they build up to him is great.
Yeah.
And then, like, I roll my eyes at the MODOK hate, because I get it. I don't have any comics background, but it's inherently got to be a goofy thing. It's literally a head on a flying thing. Like, and those are some of the funniest things. I think to bring Darren back is funny in that way.
No, agreed. And because it was not like a great villain, as we've said before, in the first Ant-Man movie. So I'm kind of okay with them playing with that. And
And now my last Avenger note here is so funny.
It is.
An Avenger. They're and like, sure, yeah.
Like, I think it's telling that before the Jonathan Majors controversy, that was something that like critics consistently noted as high point of this movie.
Even and haters were like, yeah, he's pretty good.
And then, you know, so if you think about that from the like at the time of release, that's a huge win when that's the ultimate villain that you're setting up for the whole saga. And that is no longer the case. But like, I think if you come out of a movie and you're really invested and really kind of impacted by this villain, then I think that deserves some recognition.
Five movies left. I think that Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 is the least impactful tier one film ever. That's my premise. I remember leaving going, that was really good. That's up there with that bottom of tier one. I think in a lot of ways it is slightly better than Far From Home and Love and Thunder. But this is horrible. I almost forget it exists. I think because it was the end of this trilogy, and then James was like very clearly leaving, and he was at that point not interested in doing anything on the greater MCU front.
He was already at DC at this point.
Right. And I just need to wrap up my story.
Yeah.
So it's very like isolated in that. It's very well done. But I never go back and watch it. I don't remember it being like unbelievably funny or unbelievably emotional. I know the ending works really well. So this is a weird way to say, because it sounds like I'm being negative. I think it's a tier one film, but
you have some complicated feelings about James Gunn also.
And they're getting worse. They're getting worse. Every day that passes, I'm starting to like James Gunn less. So that's, it's literally, I think, causing me to not go back to this film, which is so unfortunate. But I think it's tier one. Do you agree it's tier one?
I agree.
But I don't revisit it. I don't know. I have a lot of questions for it being a tier one, but it's tier one.
I really like this movie. You know, again, I always say this, the Guardian stuff I love a lot. I just almost view it as a separate franchise from the MCU. Like, as I know that it's hooked in, and I love the role that those characters play in Infinity War and Endgame. So I'm not wishing that away, but I just, like, I love it. It does not make me feel the way that I feel when I'm watching like an Avengers adjacent right. movie. And so I always kind of think of it as a different category in that way. But I think that this is really strong. Like, it looks great. Like, I maintain James Gunn, talking about high floors, has a very high one. I think I'm higher on Guardians 2 than you are. We talked about that last time. But I think Guardians 2 is you know, the worst that he's done of the things that I've seen that he's made. Like, I think Guardians 3 is one of his better works. And again, yeah, it's not super impactful to the MCU, but I do think that it's a really strong film, and it's a really strong conclusion to a trilogy. Like, again, talking about the best trilogies. So I do think it's firmly tier one for me, which is kind of rare for these post-Endgame projects. Like you said, I think obviously, as we're looking, so many of them live in that tier two space.
The Marvels.
I like our odds.
The Marvels is a forgotten movie that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
That's my summary.
I don't have a ton to say about this either. I've recently rewatched both this and Captain America: Brave New World. And I think The Marvels is, it, to me, it seems pretty good. Like, I think it's,
yeah, it's tier three.
It's one of those where, like, you and I didn't really connect as much with the initial Captain Marvel, or at least parts of it. There were parts of it that worked really well. I think it's probably, in retrospect, it is a little bit tighter than The Marvels, but I think that there are things about The Marvels that I like more. Like, I really like Iman Vellani, and she's really funny in that movie.
Huge addition.
And yeah, like, I think I like how creative it is, like, with the different worlds. I think that's, even if you think that it's too goofy, again, I'm kind of like, you know, we're this many movies, we're like getting close to 30 by the time The Marvels comes out.
It should be noted that these are the two coolest posters on the whole graphic. Right? Tier three. Yeah. It's a great poster for The Marvels.
Yeah. The villain in this movie is pretty weak.
Darben, yeah.
And that's a bummer to me.
I think it's an improvement over Captain Marvel in a lot of those ways. I think it's funnier. I think it looks pretty cool, actually. There are a couple VFX things in this that I think look spectacular. The clip I just played from the final fight is really well imagined. The three of them trading, places as they're being at Darben.
The swapping fights are cool.
Is cool. And I think I appreciate, for the most part, that it's a pretty tight film. It's like 100 minutes long. It's not like a epic saga. It's kind of just a chapter. And I like that Captain Marvel's having to wrestle with some of her past and some of her mistakes or decisions. I think that's a pretty cool motivator for the story.
Yeah.
The whole idea that she's the Annihilator and that somebody could view this character so differently, whereas Earth views her as this one thing, but the villain's not like unbelievable. It's kind of in so many ways to me a little bit different than Quantumania, like the opposite of Quantumania, in that like Quantumania has all these big swings in every category. In the jokes, in the visuals, in the storyline, it's trying the craziest stuff. And some of it works, and so I think that's good. And then some of it's a big miss, like a really big miss. I feel like The Marvels is pretty safe.
I think that's right, yeah.
Like, for what they were trying to do, it's a pretty good movie. Like, it doesn't do anything to reinvent anything, but it also doesn't have any, like, moments where you fall, like, flat in your face, I don't think.
I think that's right. Like, I think it's kind of weird where it falls alongside Secret Invasion. like,
yeah, correct. But that's not this movie's fault.
No. But like, there are things like that where it's like if you watch Secret Invasion, Nick Fury, and then watch this, it doesn't feel like they're the same character.
Again, it's the, that is the problem of Marvel Studios and their approach to the multiverse saga. We've talked about that off air a ton. It's not that any one of these things are wrong. It's that they needed a through line. And like, even just rearranging the order of these viewings would help.
Yeah.
Like, if this was coming out the same time as Secret Invasion-ish, like, I don't want you in the Secret Invasion headspace when you're watching the Marvels.
I would almost like,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a way to do this. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that at one point, the Marvels was supposed to precede Secret Invasion. And I think that that actually works a lot better in some ways because, you know, it's like you see Nick Fury in that post-credit scene in Far From Home, and he looks and acts about like he acts in the Marvels, and he's on the same, like, space station. Then you see him in Secret Invasion and he's like grizzled and cynical. And so it's like, wait, so he went from being this, came back down and had like a cynical couple of weeks and let his beard grow out. And then he went back up and just like snapped back to like good old like breezy Nick.
But this is where you and I can help, right?
Yeah.
The watch order can actually help with that, I think.
I think that's right. I will also say just a shout out to this movie. I still think that this is like I love the costume design and whole like visual design of Captain Marvel in this movie. I think she looks so cool.
She does.
Brie Larson like has a level of like charisma at points in this that I feel like she didn't bring as much to the first one.
She's
or
way better than the first one.
Yeah, like I think it. That like, and also visually, the one scene that I really love, just the look of, is the first time we see her on the ship, like on her ship.
Yeah.
And Goose is there. And like, it's cool. Like it's cooler.
Oh, it's cool. It's very Star Wars-y.
Yeah.
In the visuals.
Like I think, so I do, there are things about this that every time I see it, I like, and I'm like, it makes me excited to see more of that in like whatever next Avengers movie. Like I feel like we've gotten Captain Marvel in a good spot. And I like the story that they like the seeing the follow up of how she tried to fight back against the Kree Empire and how that kind of created more issues. And then her having to wrestle with that,
yeah,
I think is an interesting story for Carol.
I think it's a, like the tier says, it's a pretty good movie. People give it hate because of all these off screen things, but it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
Only plot point I don't love there is the very end that she can just fly into the sun and that would have solved the whole problem kind of thing. Like a little bit of the Trump card thing. Like, okay, we should have maybe led with that. And then we wouldn't have any of this. Deadpool and Wolverine.
Man, it's hard again, because this is a movie that doesn't have a ton of connection to the wider MCU.
Right.
But I think, if we normally look at this in terms of what's it trying to do and how well is it doing that, I think that this is an elite film. Like I think it's like it. This is one where it's easy to look at it as like when you think about Deadpool and Wolverine. Like we've done these episodes before where it's like, what's the first thing you think of? It's easy to go to kind of some of the many like goofy, maybe over the top goofy moments here and then think like, ah, it's a Deadpool movie, like it doesn't really do the stuff that I like the core Marvel movies to do. But I think like even setting aside the emotional pieces of this, which are not the strongest points of the movie anyway, like the way a lot of this is visualized, like the opening credits are so fun.
Yeah.
Like the like using Logan's skeleton as like a bunch of weapons. And then like the end with the like a prayer use, both like fighting through the street and the final scene with him and Logan, like it's one of the more fun Marvel movies just in terms of like a popcorn flick. And I think
the nod from Deadpool
in the post in game slate.
The nod from Deadpool at Hugh Jackman's abs is funny. It gets me in the very serious moment. He just goes,
I still think like the like solidly great till Endgame line is like a really like perfect way of addressing the like, you know, polarizing feelings about certain projects without going to, without like throwing anyone under the bus or like trying to throw any of those projects like specifically under the bus.
Yeah.
I think that there's not a ton beyond that for me to say, but I do think it's tier one.
Yeah, for me, I agree. I think listeners of this podcast have become fully aware at this point that I am probably extremely biased toward the interconnectedness of this. If you told me that Marvel Studios was just going to turn into a individual movie company, yeah, I would be infinitely less excited. So there is, I realize there's a scale there and I'm on the far end of it. And so part of my critique of the film is just that it wasn't more connected. Like it was supposed to be the next step in the multiverse saga. And once again, I'm like, we got a fun story that really doesn't connect other than the TVA to like at the very end of the movie, they actually stay in their own universe. There's not even like a, they yeah. come over. So I'm acknowledging that's not fair for me to hold those movies to that standard. Like that's not a movie critique. That's a entire saga critique.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty funny. And all the things you said are true. The visuals are good. The music is cool at the very end, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Captain America, Brave New World. This is a little bit of a weird one for me.
Yeah.
Because I think I do like it, but unlike what I just said with Deadpool and Wolverine, I think there are actual film-making critiques that are valid. Like, just straight up, like, yeah, the plot and things like that, where you go, this is not just mega fans going, look, by the way, our chart is perfectly balanced. It's a perfect pyramid right now.
That's all things should be.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like I don't view this movie and then I hear the critiques and go, wow, that's just fans being ridiculous. Like I sometimes do with, like, Quantumania.
Yeah.
This is like, no, there's just some things that are actually fundamentally wrong. I do wonder if the marketing had somehow found a way to not reveal the Red Hulk ahead of time. I think that actually could have been pretty cool. That you're like, oh my gosh, Ross has turned into a Hulk during all this time.
Yeah.
What the heck? And that's what he's fighting. Okay. That's kind of cool to me. But we knew that was coming.
Yeah.
So that's a little less cool. I think Sam Wilson does a really good job as a Captain America figure.
Yeah.
And for the most part, I think it looks pretty cool. I think it's pretty fun and breezy in that way. Like it's a tight story. It's not long and drawn out. I think the Bucky reveal is pretty cool when he shows up, although the Senator thing's a little strange, but when he shows up, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But there are actually just some lines that are weird and there are some actual plot devices that are underbaked. I don't know where to put this.
Yeah. You know, like I said, I rewatched this recently for the first time. Like this is one of the few that I only caught once in theaters.
And I feel like even the public is kind of mixed on this, by the way. Like I've seen people on like Threads and on X go, what was I missing? Captain America is actually pretty sweet. What are you talking about? I've seen a lot of those on my feed that they're now seeing on Disney Plus. And then I've seen a lot of people being like, I'm just now seeing Disney Plus and wow, I get it. This was a misstep. You know?
Yeah. On a second watch for me, it stayed about the same. Like it didn't get better. I don't know that it got worse, but I was hoping, you know, sometimes a rewatch can really help things. And I
like this more on my second watch.
Yeah, this is tough for me. I think it's just like a lot of it just doesn't click. Like on paper, I'm okay with a lot of what they're doing plot wise, but like some of the performances seem kind of off to me throughout. Like a lot of what you would talk about as like side characters. I think I don't know. It's strange. Like it needed to be like, it needed a better editing job. I think what I said when the first movie came out holds. Like I think the script is weak, the editing is weak, and then some of the performances are weak. And so it's hard to like, even if stepping back, there are things I love about it. Like I love that we finally had a movie that is sort of bringing some threads together, which is something we sorely needed in the MCU.
Although one of those major threads, I wish they probably would have ignored now in hindsight.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think that's one of this movie in general was a big swing, and that's because it was recasting Ross as Harrison Ford and introducing the Red Hulk. It was also bringing back a lot of the Incredible Hulk stuff, which is a movie that a lot of people for the longest time didn't even think of as real canon to the MCU. And then the Eternals connection, where it's just like...
And Adamantium, theoretically, yeah, like, you know, hinting at an X-Men thing.
And I think it's like, if this movie had been great, like if Thunderbolts, which we'll talk about in a second, had done all of that, then I think I would have been like, holy cow, like the kind of the way I felt about Endgame when they redeemed the Dark World and all this stuff, where it's like, oh, you're, wow, like, if you had told me I'm going to do this, I would have said, don't do it. But now look how well you pulled it off. And this is an example of, I've seen Marvel do it so well, so many times, that when I saw they were doing all this, I was like, okay, yes, like, let's, I love it. Like, I love the ambition. And then I watched it and I was like, maybe a little too ambitious, actually.
Yeah. So I mean, I could be swayed on this one. This is not a hill I'm going to die on. At times I've had this in tier three around like the Marvels era, Quantumania, like it's pretty good, but I also could be literally argued that it's the worst one of the whole bunch. Literally. I if you want to put it here as the last film in tier four, I'm okay with that. But if you want to put it up here in pretty good, I'm okay with that too. This is the one where I'm just not going to die on this hill.
I think it's tier four. For me,
it's just okay. as much as
I would like it to be tier three, if only for what would make for a symmetrical final stacking here.
Good point.
It is one of the few movies where I think that it was poorly made in certain ways.
Yeah. Okay, I want to get on my soapbox for 1 second here on Thunderbolts. I think Thunderbolts. Is unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And I don't have purpose. It's just 100% my scene. And I realize me going this far with this film is going to put you in a weird spot, because if you don't feel that way, then you have to be the bad guy and be like, I have to lower it a little bit. I think I watched it and I loved it. And then I went a second time with my wife and loved it even more, getting to see her reaction to it. I have so confidently recommended Thunderbolts to non-MCU people. My brother, Grant, Randall. I go, you need to go see Thunderbolts. My dad and my friend Randall, for example, went to see Thunderbolts, loved it, and then went back and took his family. I have virtually... no complaints in this film. I think it's funny. I think it's one of the best looking Marvel films ever made, literally, yeah. Just because the lack of CGI. I think the premise is unbelievably executed and so important.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that they did that with some B-level characters,
yeah,
is amazing. And then the meta tie-in that they become the new Avengers, but even the post-credit sequence of people are kind of like the B-Avengers. Like, this is not obviously is amazing. I think Bob is awesome and terrifying. And the way they talk him off a ledge, the sequence of him beating himself up and all of the Thunderbolts hugging him and pulling him back is so moving. When I think Florence Pugh delivers an unbelievable performance. And when she is in that showdown with Red Guardian and she's doing the whole like, I hate my life. I don't do anything. I sit at home. I look at my phone, which I think is a really on the nose, but effective message for today's day and age. Like, I think that is in real life, by the way, is causing problems. And so to have someone her age admitting like, this is, my life is messed up. I feel empty. I don't feel fulfilled. I think is amazing that people are having to wrestle with that. And while that's happening, it's happening in a Marvel film and it looks amazing and it's funny and the action's cool. And I like the development for almost every character. I mean, John Walker's better, Ghost is better, Red Guardian takes a step forward, Bucky's awesome. I virtually have nothing to complain. I think it's by far the most tier one film we have. I think it's a clear step up over Guardians of the Galaxy 1. I would watch this for me personally. I can't move. It's not letting me go. What the heck?
This okay. is a pro there, James there go, there Gunn go, there go, there platform. Go. It's, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's only James Gunn films. I'll move it for you, but just know on my preference list, this is like currently it's like a top seven movie.
I think I could go either way between this and Guardians 3. Sort of stepping back, I think I'm not sure there's a right answer there. I think it's pure preference. I think they're both really well made. I think they're both really tight. I think that it just sort of plays to what style of movie you prefer and which kinds of characters within the Marvel universe you connect with more. I am with you in that. I mean, I said this in our initial reactions. This is what I was hoping Captain America Brave New World would be. And it does all this ground level stuff, and it's also creative, and it also moves the ball forward. It's what we used to take for granted in the Infinity Saga. Like when you had movies like whether it's Civil War or Ragnarok, you know, where it's like, holy cow, I didn't know they could do this. And they introduced all this stuff and they juggled all this and it's funny and it's cool. And like this movie is like, if this had come out, and I mean, this movie's gotten excellent reviews, and I think almost everyone I've talked to loved it.
I don't know a single person that doesn't like it.
No, the people that I've talked to that don't love it still liked it. I just think that it's like they're, you know, people have various things, but that's only maybe one or two. Like, it is unquestionably one of, if not the best movies that they've made. Again, I like that No Way Home can be in the S tier because I do think that it's hard to compare there. But I think people like or love Thunderbolts. So I'm not saying it's in any way underrated, but in terms of like the impact that it has had, whether you're talking about box office or just how much it's part of the conversation.
I hate that you brought that up, but I get that. I get it. I hate that though. That's the only part of the conversation that people...
No, but here's my, like, the reason like I bring that up.
It wasn't a cultural moment like No Way Home was, which I hate that it wasn't. It should have been.
But the reason I bring that up is like, you know, of course it wasn't. Like, we talk about Guardians 1, and you and I talked about this the other day. Like, I think there are a lot of comparisons that can be made between Guardians 1 and Thunderbolts in terms of the tone, what it's doing, B-list characters. But I think that the difference is Guardians hit right as people were like really starting to get invested in the MCU. So there were a lot of eyes on it. People were really curious. People thought like, oh, this might fail. And then it did. And then it was huge. And, you know, the rest is history. I think if Thunderbolts had come out, like if you had a post-Endgame MCU that was like WandaVision, Falcon Winter Soldier, Far From Home, and then Thunderbolts, you know, like in terms of like, we're kind of like now here's the new story. I think it would have been like a smash because you remember how invested, I mean, our like the podcast, like around the time of WandaVision, we've talked about this, just like exploded. There were all these people I knew that had never cared about Marvel, even in the tail end of the Infinity Saga, that were now like watching these Disney Plus shows weekly, that were going to see every movie. Like, I feel like all these 2021 movies, including Eternals.
Yeah, WandaVision was the most that Disney Plus ever commanded the week-to-week thing, ever.
Yeah.
But that was their first thing, too. But you know what I mean? Like, that was...
But it's like, yeah, I think by the time Thunderbolts came out, it was sort of like, okay, well, you know, there's a new Marvel movie. It's, let's flip a coin and see whether we care, like from the public.
I totally agree. I am tired. I don't want to give that caveat to anyone. Like in 5 years, I'm not going to say, oh, and it was a smaller box office film. I don't care. I'm just saying as a movie, it's awesome. It's freaking awesome. And so the fact that more people didn't see it, shame on you people that didn't see it. I mean, that's on you. You now, you didn't get to experience it.
Yeah. So, but is it shame on them? Because like, if they're not like,
it's you an know, awesome film. Yeah.
No, it
you
is
missed
an
out
awesome,
on an awesome film because you know, had some preconceived notion about it.
But I'm not saying like, I think that that's fair. Like if you're someone that's only casually interested in the MCU and you are kind of, you're feeling like it's been hit or miss, You're not invested in the overall story. Like we've said, you're not seeing the through line. And then you see Thunderbolts, and it's a bunch of characters that are like none of them have been protagonists that you have followed or have been really curious about. Like, I don't know what the get, like,
it's what's still the hook? Funny. It's still funny, and it's still moving about friendship.
We're arguing different things.
No, I understand why it's small, Robbie. I understand why the box. You're right. There isn't a hook. Like, why would they check it out? I get that.
Right.
I'm just saying I'm tired of that conversation. It has nothing to do with the movie.
No, but I think it has something to do with
this. This is
the
a
trajectory.
Pitch you're giving to Marvel's marketing department right now.
Well, no, not the marketing department. I'm saying the like Marvel Studios in terms of like we're now at the end of all the films that have come out post Endgame. And my point is, if you had cut down on some of these or resequenced them, and that's why the watch order is fun, like
okay, sure.
I just think that like I guess what I'm saying is the shame to me is that it took us this long to get to a movie like Thunderbolts.
Okay. I agree that they have mishandled the overall multiverse saga. Lack of through threads, a lack of a plan of what's happening, and then a lack of a release strategy. Like this release order that we just ranked in doesn't make sense. It just doesn't. Especially if you factor in the shows. I agree with that. Like once you start getting invested in the shows, to go from low-key to random things, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I think that's the like, and again, I think things are shifting. We've talked about this. Like, so this is not a like, oh gosh, Marvel's lost its way, like diatribe. It's just that I look at this and I wish that Marvel had served this movie better by not burning so much credibility in like 2021 and 2022. And I don't mean because Marvel was putting out bad things. Like as we go through the shows, as we've gone through this, like you're going to see, it's not like we're saying that.
Yeah. There's a lot in the top three tiers here.
Yeah. Like we're not saying that they've been bad. It's just, it doesn't feel like there's care put into like the overall project. And I think that is why, like that's why I would say I don't necessarily blame somebody that is not as invested in the MCU as we are for missing out on Thunderbolts. But I do think that, as you and I have said, when Thunderbolts hits Disney Plus, I think that there's going to be a huge moment of people discovering what they missed out on.
Yeah, I agreed with that. I just want the focus to be on how good Thunderbolts as a film is. And the A24 approach was so cool. And I really pray that Disney does not take the lack of box office success as a sign that this is not the way to do it. This is the way to do it. Have this much care in your story.
Yeah.
This is the way to do it. It's just a shame because of those other cultural elements. Yes, I agree. I hope it has crazy second legs on Disney Plus. People are going to go, holy crap, this is what I didn't go see. It's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, there it is. There's our rankings.
Yeah, if you're listening and not watching, shame on you.
Yeah, shame. Dude, I got real mad there at the end. Hey, check out our new merch. The only film that we're going to be able to add to this ranking list, we can do a little update on social media, is Fantastic Four in July. And then we don't have another film for months and months. So this list is pretty set here. And you can find the complete rankings of all of our Marvel films on our website, theffwpodcast.com. But as always, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And check out this YouTube channel. Subscribe below if you want more updates from us. We're going to be covering Ironheart. We're going to be covering Fantastic Four in full. Lots of episodes on Fantastic Four, including some episodes on the old Fantastic Fours on Friends From Work Plus. Check out our podcast. We really appreciate you all joining us. Thank you for going along on this long journey. I thought this would be the short one with only 13 films.
Here we
go. It ended up being longer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time here on Friends From Work.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.